Yeah. About that, huh? Looks exotic.
It does.
Looks a little weird.
It doesn't look that weird. Okay. I mean, okay, it does look a little weird. I've never seen a glass salt rimmed using some sort of dark lava salt. What kind of salt is this?
It's black Hawaiian.
Black Hawaiian lava salt.
Yes. Yep. Unfortunately, it's not sea salt, which is what I thought it was when I got it.
Oh, okay.
So it's just kosher salt, but it's still tasty. But yeah, so I wanted to try something a little bit new. So you've had a salty dog at some point in your life, right?
Probably.
I mean, it's just...
I am a salty dog.
I actually thought about making that joke and I was like, I'm just going to skip right by it.
Yeah. It's the low-hanging fruit and you know how I can't resist that.
That is the second time someone's used the low-hanging fruit phrase in the last 5 hours of my life. It's weird how that happens. So salty dog is simply a greyhound with a salt rim. A greyhound is simply grapefruit and vodka.
Okay.
So by degrees. So this is a black salty dog, I've decided to call it. Salty black dog. Salty black dog.
All right. Well, let's give her a try.
Yeah, don't clink because the salt's going to fall off.
That's some crunchy salt.
It is. You can get a couple sips out of one lipful.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's not super sweet. You know, the grapefruit is it's a good amount. I think grapefruit's a good kind of drink fruit juice for me.
Because it's not naturally super sweet.
Yeah.
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 I'm with you. And if we want more salt, I thought we'd just bring the salt bowl down.
If I just want to lick out of that bowl, that's fine. That's what you've been doing, I assume.
I won't judge you. I had a mouthful of salt and liquor at that point, but I would not judge you. Yeah, don't worry about it. I got a vacuum anyway. Salt drops keep falling on my head. So hi.
What's new? Hi. Hey.
Been a little while.
This is a low-key intro.
Right?
How are we doing? We're buddies in space.
Yeah, you're...
IMS Michael Smith, and you, sir.
Oh, sorry. M. Michael Carousey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we're buddies in space.
We are.
Hi. Hey.
So we saw Deadpool finally.
You hadn't seen it yet?
No, we wanted to. We couldn't, you know.
Oh yeah, we saw it with Ben and Jen because Ben finally talked Erica into seeing it.
Yeah, it was good. We both liked it. The wife and I. It was very entertaining. Having read a few Deadpool comics, I thought it did a good job of staying close to the spirit of the comics, and in a lot of ways,
yeah,
but still being pretty accessible, I think.
You don't need a
new audience.
You don't need to know about the fourth wall thing or the Merc with the Mouth thing. Like, you don't need to know that going into it.
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I did know that.
No, but I felt like when I was watching it, I was thinking about that just lightly because I enjoyed the whole thing. But I was thinking, like, you really don't, like, you can just go into this and it's just a fucking funny lewd movie.
Just take it. This is a send up of superhero movies.
Right.
And done.
Like, there, Deadpool is sort of a send up of comic book characters. So yeah. It sort of just carries over.
Yeah. It wasn't, I mean, some of the, it's like the CGI Colossus was a little distracting.
They did so much practical stuff in it.
Yeah.
And the other CG was really good, like that opening sequence.
Yes.
Very well done.
Yeah. But the Colossus was just kind of...
Colossus is difficult to do well, I feel like. I feel like they've done him a couple times. I've never been like, oh, that's a really good Colossus. You know?
I like the other character. I'd never even seen her before.
That was random. Like, just the origins of that character and everything, and they're just like, yeah, we'll just go with Teenage Negaton Girl, or whatever her name is.
I mean, she out of the comics? Or
yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I think her name is Teen Negaton Girl.
I believe it.
I mean, really weird. But yeah, they did a lot of, so I guess the really great gag with the duffel bag, I'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
How he, with the cab.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, there was supposed to be an $8 million fight scene. And then Fox was like, you guys are getting a lot of hands, so we're going to cut $8 million out of the budget. So they're like, oh, okay. So the Indiana Jones did. They're like, big, okay. But I thought it worked very well for that character.
Yes. A lot of good work. The guy they had playing the bartender, he was great.
TJ Miller, I think
it is. Yeah. That's
Erica
right.
Loves him. He's everywhere.
The woman they had playing Al, she was great.
Someone was claiming that was... Uhura.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. it was really random that they thought. Like, they were convinced.
No, she was a lot shorter than...
Yeah, Aurora was, like, tall and statuesque.
Yeah. No. But yeah, a good film. Very, very entertaining.
I can't imagine anyone other than Ryan Reynolds doing that character.
Yeah.
I really can't. It's just one of those things. It's like Patrick Stewart playing Professor X.
Yeah, and it's funny how they... we watched some of the extras on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we watched everything yet, but some of the stuff was talking about how they got the film made. And Ryan Reynolds, who obviously played Deadpool in the horrible Wolverine movie.
Yeah.
And of course that was a terrible Deadpool. And it was just stupid.
They took away the mouth from the guy who's known as the Merc with the Mouth.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah. It was pointless, but from doing that, I guess Reynolds got interested in the character.
Yeah.
And as he, like, you know, he read the comics and he's like, oh, this is actually a really cool character. Wouldn't it be cool if we could actually do a movie like this? And he was a big proponent. He was probably the main guy who was pushing.
He was championing it for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not unlike Seth Rogen with Preacher. Like, even with a celebrity, it takes a while for a movie to get made. And they conveniently leaked test footage a couple years ago. And that got everyone, like, super, like, excited for it. So I think that was intentional.
Yeah. They said that they still don't know who did it, but Reynolds is, like 90% sure it was their director.
Yeah, but you know what? It worked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hard to argue with success.
Yeah. People went crazy for that. Yeah. Great movie. Loved all the fourth wall stuff. I mean, that's intrinsic to the character, but whether or not you know that going in, it's just funny.
Yeah, well, it starts off with that. I mean, that's the beginning of the movie is him talking to you. So it's all good. What else? We saw a kind of obscure movie. It was in the theater. We actually saw a movie out in the theaters.
Whoa.
I know. Ooh.
Did you see Lobster?
No, we didn't see Lobster. We almost did. We saw, I think it's April and the Amazing World.
Okay.
Or Magnificent World. It's April and the Something World. It's originally French, and I think the literal translation is April and the Twisted World.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the translation they went with is like April and the Magnificent World or the Amazing World or whatever.
Okay.
But it's an animated movie.
Of course.
Of course. It's French.
Of course.
Unfortunately, we saw trailers for it that were in French with English subtitles. And, like, this looks really cool.
Oh, no. Was it dubbed?
It was dubbed.
Ah. Yeah. Why? In this day and age? In a theater?
Well, yeah. But, you know, it was like, they gave it the Miyazaki treatment, and it had, you know, like, Susan Sarandon and, oh, my gosh, J.K. Simmons. Okay. And, oh, my gosh, I can't think of their names now. I'm terrible with actor names. The guy from Shoot 'Em Up. Bad guy.
Oh, Paul Giamatti?
Paul Giamatti, yes. He was one of the main voices. A couple of other people. I can't remember them all. But they do that. You know, they get that, hey, it's an artsy movie with the star-studded cast.
Mm-hmm.
I would have rather seen the original French.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it, there was an attitude to it, and it came across in the trailer. And I'm being a super foreign movie subtitle snob here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just in watching the trailer, you get a lot more character out of it that matches the animation, matches the, you know, the way that the characters move and the way they should be talking.
I think that's fair. Even in animation, there's still, in foreign animation, there are culturalisms.
Yeah.
You know?
So, like, there's a cat there's a talking cat in it.
A talking cat?
Yes. And seeing the cat talk in French was much more interesting to me than hearing it talk in English.
Because was Paul Giamatti the cat?
No. No. Was it J.K. Simmons the cat? Maybe.
Did he berate drummers?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he did not. But it was a good movie. It wasn't a great movie. It's gotten crazy reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. It's like 98% or something.
Okay.
It's a good family movie. There's a little bit of violent-y things happening, but it's, you know, not. I think a kid of like maybe 6 or 7 and up would be fine.
Mm.
It is, if nothing else, it is an homage to just about every single Miyazaki Studio Ghibli movie out there.
Okay.
And I mean that in a good way. It you know, a more cynical person would say, oh, it's ripping off Miyazaki. I'm not that person today.
I was going to say, really? You're not? Not today. Why, what have you done with my friend Mike?
Because it was clear that the movie, there was so much influence from the Miyazaki films. I mean, you could just like check them off. And it's like female main character, talking cat, a house that walks, a strong anti-war theme, other talking animals, lots of flying. It was every Miyazaki trope was in there in some form or
it
another.
It seems like it, yeah.
Yeah. And it was a good film. It was entertaining. It was good. I'd recommend it. Probably not going to be able to see it in a theater. I think it was out for like a week.
Wow. Did you see it at the Little?
Yeah. Saw it at the Little. Of course.
Of course.
Which is our local art house theater.
Hey, we're lucky to have one.
Yeah. And we just decided we'd rather see something like animated and kind of a big screen experience than The Lobster. We'll rent The Lobster eventually.
I'll watch it with you. I have no desire to see it in the theater.
You know, okay.
It sounds intriguing, but those kind of movies I don't need to see in the theater.
Yeah.
They're small screen movies. You know?
Sure.
I mean, screen by modern standards, which is 60 inches. It was 60 inches.
Yes. So, there we go. That's my exciting news, which is not terribly exciting. So, what you been up to?
Celebrate an anniversary.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You had a little trip.
We did our first night away from the child.
Did you feel guilty about it?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Well, because, like, my mother-in-law was texting us pictures. Like, he was clearly having a good time with her. And he fell asleep in a good amount of time. And, you know, like, we try to make it very easy for when one of Erica's parents watches him. Like, they come to our house and everything's baby-proof. They don't have to worry about much.
Right, right.
We provide all the food, so they, you know, we provide food he'll eat, which is concerned with him. So it's just come and play with him for, a combined 8 hours between after nap and when he wakes up, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she had never seen Iron Giant, and that's his new obsession, is the movie Iron Giant.
Oh, so you did watch that with him, finally.
Oh, yeah, and then we watched it again. And again, Star Wars is completely forgotten.
Ah.
It's now Iron Giant 24/7. Which is fine. Nice. I mean, it's a great movie to be hooked on. It's even less objectionable than Star Wars, which isn't that bad.
And you hadn't even seen it.
No, neither of us had. What a great film.
Yeah.
And we got the signature edition, which has, they actually went back and they had intended to put two scenes in the original theatrical version that they didn't animate in time.
Oh.
So they hired a studio that does CG to replicate the hand-drawn style of 1999.
Hmm.
So it's pretty well done. I mean, when you know, you kind of see a little bit, but it's not overtly obvious. But yeah, great movie. He loves it. So we went to the Thousand Islands, and we've determined that the Thousand Islands takes exactly 8 hours. And then you have done the Thousand Islands. Unless you're filthy fucking rich and you own an island with a mansion on it.
So you got bored quickly?
We left early the next morning. No, I'm fine. Like, it worked great. So
okay.
we rolled in. I had it all timed out perfectly. And everything went off without a hitch. So we rolled in, and our motel, our resort, which was just a motel that was on the water, shared an office with the cruise, as well as the dock with the cruise we were going on. So we rolled in, couldn't check in, it was too early, left our car there, got the parking pass, walked 20 seconds from our car, and we were in line for the cruise. We had to get there early, which this luckily I.
But you already had tickets, I assume. No?
Bought the tickets, booked the room, everything was done in advance. So we sunscreened it up in line, and then we just waited, got on the boat, and we did what's called the 2.25 hour two nation tour. The two nation tour. You don't need a passport, but
two nation tour.
I kept making that joke. Erica wasn't into it. So it's just, you go around the Thousand Islands.
That low-hanging fruit.
Right? Sometimes nothing wrong with it, man. It's just okay. Drink break. Ooh, a lot of salt. So we toured around the Thousand Islands. You know, got a wine slushy, sat out in the sun.
Oh.
It was awesome. And except for it wouldn't be for you.
I know. I say, and then, that would kill me.
Well, Eric got a daiquiri, so there
okay.
you go. And then we got out. So at the end of the tour, you can get out at Bolt Castle. You know the whole story about Bolt Castle?
Mm-mm.
So it's a famous castle. So the story is very, very tragic. It's very, very moving.
Was this the one that they never finished building or something?
Yeah, well, 95% completed.
Okay.
So George Bolt a Prussian immigrant, came over with nothing, started as a like a busboy or a dishwasher at like the Four Seasons. His only job he could get. And he eventually worked his way up to owning like two huge hotels. And when he was young, he met the love of his life, Luisa. So they got married, and he, as he became more successful, he wanted to build like a castle for his wife.
Like a real castle.
A real legitimate Rhineland castle. So he built it in the style of the Rhine. So took years, and he was actually the one who kind of built up the Thousand Islands into a place for rich people to build houses.
Like, okay.
He was the one who did it. So he had this castle built, and it's 120 rooms. It has, like, I think it could, what did I say? It's a ridiculous fact. If it had been completed and actually used, it could house 25 families of four, and every single one of them would have at least one fireplace. It's just ridiculous. So they were working on it, and they were 95% complete, putting the finishing touches on it. It had a powerhouse. He had a man cave that was awesome. It was a tower, and each floor was a different activity. It had this, like, little, really pretty little gazebo, and then a henery, which I put on Facebook. It looks like something right out of The Witcher. It's like just a perfect wizard's tower.
Okay. What'd you call it?
A henery.
Henery.
Henery. It's where we keep the hens. It's where we hen them in. It's the henery.
All right.
So at the 95% completion point, the workers got a telegram that said, stop all work. Luisa has died.
Just like a Windows upgrade.
Right? Bam. Blue screen of
95%.
Wife's death.
No! Sorry. Terrible to make light of this.
You know, the statute of he was rich. No, you're right. It's awful. It's sad. So he never wanted to set foot on the island again. He never did. So this castle, they put God knows how much of money at that time. It was like the early 1900s, very early 1900s. I think 1900 to 1904 or something like that. So the workers were like, okay. They just put their tools down and walk off the island and just sat there for 70 years. So it basically probably kind of looked like Crimson Peak. Like it was just getting run down and shit. And then the Thousand Islands like Transit Authority or something bought it for $1 in the 70s. And since then, they've pumped in $34 million into renovating it. And it is nowhere close to done. Like, I heard that and I'm like, oh, this is going to be beautiful. It's going to be, you know, hand-carved wood and marble everywhere. It needs a lot of work. I'd say at least probably three quarters of it are still.
Wow.
Maybe two-thirds. I'll be generous. Two-thirds.
So this might be what you would call a boondoggle.
Well, no. So what they're doing is every dollar that it makes goes into renovation. So it's sort of a self.
Okay.
So I guess it just pays for its employees and renovating the castle. So everywhere you look is like carpentry stands and like they're doing work all over. But it was cool. I mean, you can go through most of the castle. But it's weird. You'll be walking through like a beautifully furnished, finished room because they got some of the family's furniture back in it. And then you walk in, like you go through a doorway and then it's like graffiti and plaster peeling off of the walls. And you're like, that's really strange.
Oh, because it's probably just abused and vandalized
for years. Yeah, just sat there for, I mean, my mother-in-law said in 1967, she tended to get herself into some weird situations as a teenager. But because she's from Geneva, she wasn't that far from it. So she and a girlfriend like met some guys, as she put it, who said, hey, we have a boat. You want to go at the boat castle? So they just left her and her friend there for 4 hours on their own and this like decrepit castle because no one owned it back then.
Wow.
She's still mad about it to this day, by the way. It's 49 years later. She's still angry. Yeah, so we did the cruise. The cruise stops at Bolt Castle, got out, did the tour. We did it about an hour and 15 minutes, saw everything. It was cool, but you couldn't access some of the outside stuff as much, so it was kind of quick. And then we came home, took some showers because we'd been drinking in the sun on a boat. And then we went out to dinner, ate too much, got some ice cream cones, walked around, took about 10 minutes to see the whole town. And that was it. And then we went home and went to bed early. And then left early. And it was like the perfect happy anniversary. We're done. One night. So, and the Thousand Islands, I don't think has seen an update in any way since the 80s. You ever drive through?
In general.
Yeah, you just drive through one of those towns and it's like, I feel like this is the town that just sort of, it just stopped doing anything after like 85.
Yeah, that's how I felt about most of Long Island when I lived there.
Okay, I could see that. You know, like they had that slightly faded plastic signs that are in the window. That's the town of Alexandria Bay. So, I mean, you see, I mean, the houses were, oh my fucking God. Like these people have to have underwater electricity lines run to their house. Like the island living is nuts. Like just how complicated and expensive it is. But these houses, one house, the tour, they were just telling us about the houses. It's got to be weird, like owning a house and just having people like ogle it from a boat multiple times every day during the summer. But there, she was like, yeah, you see, those are two man-made waterfalls. There's another waterfall that runs through the middle of the house under the dining table. It's just like, whitewater rafting and dinner, anyone?
Well, I have a new goal now. I want to have a waterfall going under my dinner table.
I want a waterfall going through my fucking dining room table. Fuck that. I'm going to one-up that shit. And I want it operating a water wheel, and then that powers something. Something rich. Maybe it's made of gold, or it makes more gold. It's a gold wheel that, as it turns, it makes more fucking gold. I don't know. You get...
That's very...
Specific?
Rumpelstiltskinian.
Yeah.
Yes.
No. It's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, this is starting to sound a lot like a fairy tale.
But a modern update on it.
Very modern. It's the Steamboat Willie of Rumpelstiltskin's tales, which is also really outdated.
What? Steamboat Willie. I don't know where you're going with that.
Oh, that got away from me a long time ago. Isn't that clear? I've almost finished my drink. Yeah. But the whole 1%, 99% disparity?
Yeah.
Really obvious when you're on one of those cruises.
Yes. And that's probably even more like a 0.5 or something percent.
Yeah. Yeah, to be able to sustain even a summer home in those kind of conditions. And they all burn down constantly. She's like, yeah, that house was rebuilt after it burned down, and that whole island caught on fire. And all I could think of was the thing in Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
Right. Well, what do you do? Do you call a fire boat?
They talked about that. Yeah, so there's three boats.
Oh, my God.
And it's pretty fun. I mean, there's like a kind of weird humor that they have out there. But, yeah, there's three boats that the fire department has. There's the last... Last Chance, the something, and then the
you're
already
fucked.
Gone. Yeah, the middle one was salvage what you can. Like, they had these really goofy names.
Nice.
So, yeah, there was a lot of weird sense of humor. Because, like, the town doesn't do shit for 6 months out of the year. Because the river, St. Lawrence, freezes over.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you can drive your car on the ice, but you'll be charged a fortune if it falls through. and you live. So that was fun. We watched Crimson Peak.
Oh, boy. We're getting to that now, huh?
I see why it was a giant failure commercially and critically.
I don't think it was that much of a failure critically.
Yeah, it was.
Are you looking it up on Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah, I figured why not.
I liked it.
I know, and I think we took your feelings on it too much to heart.
Well.
That's not your fault.
I liked it for what it was. It was kind of an old-fashioned movie. The characters and the plot were kind of secondary to everything else. Yeah. I thought it was a beautiful movie. It's a weird thing to compliment, but the costumes were amazing.
I absolutely agree.
The setting, the design they did for the house, the mansion, was also amazing.
To be fair, you're right. It's the audience score was pretty low, but the tomato score wasn't terrible.
Okay.
I think it should have been worse. Go on.
Well. And there's a line early on in the movie about the ghosts being
our metaphors. Yeah, I know.
And everything in this movie is a metaphor. Everything. And if you're looking at it through that lens, I think it's a great film. I think it succeeds very well. If you're looking at it to see, you know, nuance and characterization, that's not really there. These are not highly... These characters don't have a lot of dimensions to them.
No.
But I don't think that's the point of the movie.
Oh, I think
so.
You're
I'm
right,
willing
right.
to forgive that.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you get into it and you're like, oh, okay, I see what that scene was. And I see, okay, I get what that meant. And you start, you know, looking at all these pieces. And it's a very, very carefully crafted movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you don't like it, you can't really deny that the director had some very specific things that he was going for.
Yes, but what you are nicely putting is, how would you put it?
Hmm?
Crafted. I would put it as overly deliberate.
Okay.
So I felt a little spoon-fed.
Almost broke. I don't know. It's very...
Well, that was the only thing I liked. Well, that and the fact that I think really you can interpret the whole thing as her novel. So that I actually found comfort in that, being like, well, if I take this as not being real, but just being what the story she wrote, then I actually like that a lot more. Like, it actually really made me not dislike the movie.
Okay.
And that's my weird reaction to it, but the CG for the ghosts was horrendous. It made no sense for that to be that style. It was overt. It was clumsy.
I do agree that some of the CG in it was off-putting.
Like really jarringly off-putting, because they built, again, it's my whole thing with practical versus CG. So they built that house on a soundstage.
Yeah.
And I just was drooling over that house. Yeah. You know? And I said to Erica, I was like, the cinematographer didn't know what to do with it. So I thought the cinematography was very, very lackluster. But what I found myself doing was just staring at the set dressing the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not, I mean, to me, that is not a good movie make.
Okay.
You know, and again, this is my thing, but you know, I'm also a whore for narrative, and that was kind of like, all right.
I freely admit the narrative was not strong.
It was just so very clear.
It was like, you could see, okay, I know where this is going. I see where this is going. The plot turns were very well telegraphed.
like, you know, like lighting a bonfire. Yeah. You know that scene in Lord of the Rings when they light all the bonfires?
Yeah.
Sort of like that every fucking scene. It's like, oh, 20 minutes from now, I know where this is going. Yes. Okay, gotcha. Okay, thank you. We can extinguish your flame. Oh, he's lighting again. Oh, now I know what's happening here.
Yes.
So,
but I got past that pretty quickly when I was watching it.
Okay, I think we expected something a little bit more.
And it really wasn't sumptuous. Scary. Although Stephen King was like on record as saying it was like the scariest thing he'd seen that year.
Which makes no sense to me. No, you can't listen. That guy's crazy. He got hit by a car. What does he know?
Okay. that's legitimate. That's a fair criticism.
that's a fair critique. So, yeah, we were a little disappointed, but, you know, whatever.
So yeah, lots of eye candy in it.
Yeah.
Not the strongest of stories, but if you want to see a movie that is like 90-something% beautiful metaphor, then go for it.
If I had different expectations for it, I think I would have probably enjoyed it more. I guess. I don't know. I'm not sure what to do with Guillermo del Toro these days. Because, like, he had his Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth stage, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I am digging every... I dig your aesthetic. I dig what you're doing. I dig the stories you're telling, your makeup and costume design. And then, like, Pacific Rim is like, okay, it's just a CG fest. It was kind of silly. Like, what?
Yeah, I know my wife really liked Pacific Rim.
But she likes kaiju storylines, right?
Yeah, but so do I. But even so, this was like, oh, it was so stupid. It was a dumb movie.
It did that thing that I really dislike with CG heavy movies where it was dark a lot of the time.
Yeah, it was dark, and then all the things were like lit up neon colors.
Yeah, it makes them seem more, maybe that's the thing, just to make them seem more impressive. But I feel like CG movies are really guilty of that, like making the lighting is just dark. Maybe to hide the CG a bit. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that.
I don't like it.
Part of it.
But Transformers, granted, has a huge budget, but that at least you got to admit, like as far as CG and bright daylight, does it pretty well.
I guess.
I mean, you may have an epileptic seizure any second watching a Michael Bay Transformers movie, but there have been moments when I've watched one of those, and I'm like, this is pretty fucking impressive. I have to admit that, you know, the lighting effects, the way with light bouncing off of the Transformers, this is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
That's my
Pacific Rim was disappointing to me.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And what was that horrible thing with them and the...
Oh, God.
Under the basement,
Jesus
whatever.
Christ.
I don't even remember what
I've
it was
taken
called.
My glasses off and I'm rubbing my face.
But it was awful.
Don't be afraid of the dark.
Yeah.
I mean, when your source material is a 70s TV movie, that's probably a bad sign. But, yeah, and
it was just...
I'm going to go on record. I said we shouldn't see it.
You were right on that one.
I said, this looks terrible.
You were right on that one.
But that's the thing about Guillermo del Toro is you can't really trust him anymore. There was a time where it's like, this dude shits gold. He's probably got a gold fucking water wheel in the middle of his dining room table making more gold from a waterfall that runs through his table.
All right. So, speaking of shitting gold, and I don't really have a better way to segue to this.
You know what? I'm on board. What do you got?
I want to go back before we run out of time.
Oh, we're fine on time, but okay.
And touch on or talk about...
good point.
The 2016 Hugo Awards.
While it's still 2016.
Yes, and while they're still going on, I think they're still doing the voting process. So I'm gonna pull up this. Gotta pull this up on the phone so I don't mess this guy's name up.
Okay.
So while I'm pulling this up, a little backstory.
Hold on, let's create a new segment. Backstory! I'll work on that
song. So, the Hugo Awards are a science fiction award.
Paragon of science fiction lauds and credits.
There are two main awards in science fiction, in science fiction literature.
Nebula?
The Nebula Award and the Hugo Award. Mm. The Nebula Award, I'm trying to do this without being boring, but it's really tough.
So that, well, you have to push your glasses up with your finger.
All right. The Nebula Award is handed out by people who are within the industry, so to speak, of science fiction and fantasy writing.
Insiders and pundits, if you will.
Yes, yes. Writers, editors, that sort of thing. People who know their stuff. Professionals. So, yeah, the professionals, the people who are in, like, whatever the name of the guild is, there's, like, a big science fiction fantasy writers guild.
That's probably what it's called.
It probably is it.
Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Guild.
So they are the ones who vote on and hand out the Nebula Award.
Right.
So it's meant as an industry award. Is a good way to describe it. It's a simple way to describe it.
Is that like the SAG Awards?
Maybe.
Like the industry people handing out?
Something like that. Or maybe the Oscars, because I think the Oscars is like all inside.
They're
people.
Both, actually. Yeah, you know, yeah. So it's like the People's Choice Award.
Yes, the Hugo Award is the People's Choice
Award.
Okay,
got it.
And anybody that basically pays enough and goes to one of the big conventions gets a vote in this.
Oh, so it's about money. Awesome. Okay.
Well, it doesn't cost a lot to vote in it. You basically just have to go to a convention, I think. One of the main conventions.
All right.
Which costs money.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's meant to be a fan award, a popular award, like the People's Choice. A few years ago, I don't know when this exactly started, but you can look it up. Some of the more, the popularity of science fiction and fantasy has changed. It used to be heavy nerd, heavy geek, heavy male dominated.
Hetero,
yes,
white male with beards.
Yes, and I'm thinking of, you know, a lot of my favorites. Larry Niven, the Ringworld stuff, and like in any of the main, the well-known science fiction authors of the
Heinlein,
past. Heinlein, yeah, we could go on.
Asimov,
Sagan. Clark. But yeah,
I used to read more.
Sagan,
Carl Sagan.
He didn't write science fiction, did he?
Didn't he?
I didn't think so. Maybe I'm wrong.
Who wrote Contact?
Was that him?
I thought it was.
I don't know.
I'm not a true sci-fi
anyway,
nerd. Go on.
Older sci-fi was the domain of men, nerdy men,
smelly, unwashed science fiction men.
And that has changed over the years, which a lot of people think is a good thing. Becoming more inclusive, having more variety in your characters, well, in
less,
your storylines.
That's homogenous, for sure.
Yes. And as a result of that, lots of different books started to win the Hugo and Nebula Awards. Lots of books that you would describe as not hard science fiction.
Oh, here we go. Jesus Christ.
This is not my position.
No,
I'm
you ever watch Party Down?
Watch what?
Party Down?
No.
I think it's a pretty heavily improvised show. It was very funny. It was about, like, caterers. Very goofy show. But there was one guy, Martin Starr, was a science fiction screenwriter. And every episode, he'd go on a rant about hard sci-fi. I'm sorry. It just automatically makes me think of Martin Starr the minute you say the term hard sci-fi.
Okay, yeah. So hard sci-fi is a thing. And over time, more not hard sci-fi books and stories were winning these awards.
So would you say that, I think I've thought about this over the years, because it's kind of hard to explain hard sci-fi to someone versus like not hard sci-fi, soft sci-fi.
Okay.
But would you say that it's fair to say that hard sci-fi is deeply mired in creating a plausible, or at least very specific and finite universe based on scientific like laws and principles.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
And soft sci-fi would be more about a narrative set in a science fiction setting.
Yeah.
Without necessarily the dedication to researching and extrapolating specific technologies. And
yes. Okay. I mean, Larry Niven is classic hard sci-fi. And I love it. I love Ringworld.
Well, hard sci-fi is fairly daunting to someone who's new to it.
It's just not really. I mean, I was reading it when I was in junior high, so.
You were.
I was a nerd.
You were in Mensa and you're a nerd.
But yeah, I mean, the whole premise of Ringworld is that there's this alien civilization that built worlds that are ring-shaped, and they go around the sun. They basically, instead of having planets, have formed a ring, a habitable ring that encircles a sun.
Did you hear that? That was the sound of almost everyone listening to this podcast, either leaving or falling asleep. And then the one guy going, it's Colin, going, oh, that's like Halo.
And it is like Halo, and that's exactly where Halo got that. The whole principle of the ring world, which is if and this is hard sci-fi.
There we go.
When you need to like go back and say, okay, well, really, the original idea was like a Dyson sphere, which was encompassing an entire sun with a completely solid sphere instead of just a ring.
They did that in Halo 4.
Okay, good.
Glad to see the Halo just kept ripping yeah. Larry Niven off.
But it starts with a grand premise like that frequently for hard sci-fi.
Right.
Or something like, well, here's a time travel story, but we're going to look at, you know, what would this actually be like? And then you end up with something like, oh my gosh, why can't I think of that movie now?
Terminator.
No.
Primer.
Primer, yes.
Primer is hard sci-fi.
Primer is recent hard sci-fi, and the hardest sci-fi. I mean, it's practically impenetrable unless you watch it multiple times.
You have to watch it multiple times. Yeah. And what is very frightening is if you look up XKCD, mm-hmm. Primer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I'm not sure how accurate it is, but I have a suspicion knowing that guy's the way he writes that it is accurate. When he maps out the plot lines of Primer, yeah. And it's so dense that you almost can't, it looks like a solid black bar, but it's like hundreds of tiny lines mapping out the different things that happen in that movie every time the time trial happens. You're like, holy fuck.
Yes. Yeah. So that, in a, as nutshelly as I can get it, is hard sci-fi.
Okay. And then soft sci-fi would be like Blade Runner.
Sure.
Like, accessible, the technology is important, but it's really like a story.
Yeah.
Like, that isn't as concerned with, like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I could go along with that.
And then there's slammed
or
in the
or
S.
Or any fantasy, like a lot of
Ooh,
fantasy stuff.
Don't. That's dangerous.
Well, this is sci-fi and fantasy.
I know. Well, okay, but where does Anne McCaffrey fall?
I've never read any of her stuff.
You never read The Dragon Riders of Pern?
I know. I know of it, but I haven't.
But do you know why I'm asking this question? This is like an old, this is an old like 70s, 80s nerd question.
Throw it down. Throw it down.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Know-It-All. Okay. So your argument for why why Mighty Mouse would beat Superman was intriguing and inspired, but let me pose you this. In The Dragon Riders of Pern, in the first book, a spacefaring settle a planet, only to discover that a thing called Thread falls from the sky, and it is a caustic, incredibly dangerous, deadly substance that basically destroys their technology in a night,
mm-hmm.
and kills most of them. So stone is the only, so you can't dissolve stone for reasons. So this advanced sci-fi... Because, I mean, what else are you going to say, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as a writer, you fucking make a choice and it's like, all right, this is what we're doing. So this advanced, you know, what starts very clearly as a science fiction storyline set in the far future with space travel, almost overnight becomes a story about these people who live in caves who discover the indigenous species is fire-breathing dragons, and they can ride them and burn the thread and keep it away. So it's like the example when I was a kid of, well, is this sci-fi or is it fantasy?
I can't choose. I haven't read it, so I mean, no, you'd have to be the one to choose.
I think it ends up going more towards fantasy than sci-fi, but I think I'm wondering if the point was, hey, which am I? But anyway, I'm done. I just want to do a silly voice and explain that.
All right. So among science fiction fantasy fans, you, as you might have imagined,
are douchebags.
Okay, that's what wasn't what I was going to say, but it is entirely accurate. There is also a strong contingent who prefers the more quote-unquote classic hard sci-fi as opposed to newer
male-dominated, yeah, male-written, non-ethnically or sexually diverse,
yes,
subject matter. I mean, let's really call
and
it
the argument
it
is like, I want sci-fi. I don't want gender politics. I don't want to read. I don't want to get a book with a spaceship on the cover and read about how women are treated poorly or some shit like that.
Okay, so let's address that.
That's
right
not
off
my back voice. That is
no. Yes. Yeah, well, you're using a voice. Clearly, that's yeah not Smite. There is a case to be made because actually, Eric and I were talking about this, and it's like you. Every 1,000 words out of Trump's mouth is one word, and you're like, that's a word. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I understand that. I do agree with the concept, conceptually, of like, if you're writing a book with an agenda that tries to utilize the trappings of something like sci-fi, like, I think that can be applauded. If yeah you're trying to reach an audience and maybe expand some minds. Mm-hmm. I know that's not what you thought I was going to say. What I do think there's an issue with is trying to introduce something to be populist for the sake of just being populist and hurting the subject matter because you feel like you have to do that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Can you give me an example?
I am a classic sci-fi writer, a writer of hard science fiction, mm-hmm, and I am trying to get a new audience, or I feel pressure because of everything that's happened with the Hugo Awards.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to write a not as good book. Because I'm yeah going to try to half-heartedly and unreally, without researching it or understanding it, put in gender politics.
Okay.
Or something. Because it's topical and it will get the critics off my back. And I won't get boycotted.
I guess. I don't think that happens.
I don't think so either. But I'm sure it's happened at some point. But my yeah point is maybe that, like, that's like, but that's like taking, you know, when you look at
and
a pie
chart. And these people might think that.
Well, in their minds, that's probably what's happening, yeah, which it's not. But you know, when you look at a pie chart and there's like the part of the pie where you can label the pie, that section in the pie slice.
Okay.
And then there's the tiny, tiny sliver yeah of the pie chart that you need like a line and you need a yes table to yeah explain. That's where I feel that falls in, is that yeah indescribably small part of the
and
pie chart.
And also, it's bullshit because Ursula K. Le Guin, Left Hand of Darkness, which was critically...
Wait, didn't she write the... River?
I don't know. She wrote a lot of shit.
Ursula K. Le Guin.
A lot of good stuff.
Yeah, I read a whole bunch of her books.
The Left Hand of Darkness.
Okay, go on.
Won Hugo and Nebula Award like in 1960-something. And it was unarguably about gender politics.
Okay.
And you can't claim this is a new thing.
Earthsea.
Okay, yeah, Earthsea.
I have like all the Earthsea books.
There you go. And you go back to what? When was Star Trek? In the 50s?
60s,
okay, yeah.
First interracial kiss.
Yeah.
Is the point you're making, one of my favorite points of all time, that sci-fi has always been an excellent like venue to just to explore things like race?
Yes, and, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
And these guys are arguing against that is insane to me. Mm-hmm. Also, they're douchebags.
And they go by a moniker.
They do. There are a couple of factions with it. Of it, one I think was just puppies. Also, sad puppies.
I think it was. I thought it was just sad puppies.
Yeah, there's like a couple of factions
puppies
that
just
come together.
Just sounds like a bunch of fucking yiffers.
I know, but anyway, I think they might just be sad puppies now.
Yeah.
So anyway,
that's one faction.
So this is the faction that really matters, because.
I thought the other puppies matter.
What are the other puppies?
The rabid puppies.
Rabid puppies? Okay.
That's that like,
the
splinter
same
cell?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's that one guy who got like ousted from the awards because he's so contentious.
Yeah. Google this stuff. Look it up on your own.
It's actually very interesting. As horribly boring as it may seem,
yeah,
there's a lot of... We haven't even gotten to the good part yet.
Yeah, we haven't.
So we've discussed the douchebags. There's a lot of douchebaggery. There are these groups.
So they're
the
douchebags
because...
That it's one thing for them to say, ugh, I wish there was more hard sci-fi. I don't like this political,
girls are
racial,
icky. We don't understand them.
Social justice stuff. I don't want that. I want
that's no place in science fiction.
I want epic space battles. And that's fine. There is still that stuff out there.
Yeah.
Go.
You can be quiet about it.
You can go read it. And now that we have the internet, it's a lot easier to find. A lot easier to know what you're getting when you get what... I have a spaceship on the cover. Is it going to be lesbians killing men justly, or is it going to be space battles? I don't know.
Is the title Space Amazons? No, probably okay.
Yeah, look it up on... There's probably 100 Amazon reviews for it.
Well, we've discussed how that can go either way, but yes.
Anyway. So, because the Hugo is a popular fan-driven award...
Mm-hmm.
These people realized they could game the system.
As in protest.
In protest, yes. And get more of the sci-fi slash fantasy stuff that they preferred into the Hugo Awards.
So they thought.
Well, yeah. And the way this works is, because the Hugo is completely open, fans can vote for literally anything. Anything
that's nominated.
Anything.
That's important.
Anything. So the way it usually breaks down is because the voting is so widespread.
The nomination and voting is
widespread. Yeah, there's two phases to the voting. One is the nominating.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody gets to nominate whatever they want. And because it's so widespread, you get like things that only have like maybe... You're yawning. I know.
I'm sorry. No. I taught all day.
Like 4 or 5% of the vote get nominated.
Right.
Even less than that. You know, like you only need like 3% or something of the total nominations to get a solid nomination.
Mm-hmm.
To make it to the final list.
Which is very long.
Yeah, which is decently long. So, these puppy guys...
Had an idea
that they would... put out their own list, and they've been doing this. This isn't the first year they've done this. So they said, hey, we're going to have our endorsement list. These are the books that we think are legit sci-fi by our definitions.
But unlike endorsed athletes, these are all very unhealthy men who wrote these.
Well, and some of them are good books. I mean, it's not the books that they're nominated are not necessarily bad.
Right.
I mean, it's good stuff, but they're gaming the system to move it back to what they think sci-fi is.
They're using their clout and they're drawing attention to certain books.
Yeah.
But then the rabbit puppies got weird.
Well, okay. So they did this and lots of people have problems with it. A lot of the authors that are being nominated are like, this is bullshit. I don't want you guys to do this.
Yeah.
And if I'm getting nominated because I'm on your list, I'm just going to drop out. So people have been legitimately dropping out and saying, yeah, take my name off the nomination
list. Like in protest.
In protest mm-hmm. of this. So this year, we're getting to the good part now. I promise. I swear. This is the good part.
20 minutes later.
So in one of the lists, and this is there are Hugos for every different category. One of the categories is short story.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 2016 short story puppy approved list, among various other quote unquote legitimate entries, somebody in their infinite wisdom, being a douchebag,
it was the rabbit puppies.
It was the rabbit puppy. He said
it was very calculated.
You know what? Let's throw this other thing on here just for fun, just for the shits and giggles.
I thought it was a delegitimization move. To try to draw, like, be like, oh, look, like, you know, we can do whatever we want. Like, it's in there, but they're going to drop out because they don't belong in this list. That's how I read it.
It's hard to get into what the exact motivation
regardless,
was.
It backfired, but go on, yes.
Yeah, regardless, it backfired. And what they added to the list and what succeeded in getting enough nominations or getting enough votes to get nominated for this year's 2016 Best Short Story Hugo Award is Space Raptor Butt Invasion by Chuck Tingle.
Yep.
There you go.
Author of many a short story published and sold on Amazon that starts with Slammed in the Butt by.
Yes.
He has a whole series of books that are homoerotic in nature and involve the title Slammed in the Butt by blank.
Or rammed in the butt or rammed something in the butt.
Something in the butt.
In the butt. In the butt.
Very popular short story on Amazon.
And he's actually, from what I've heard, I haven't read the stories yet. But it's like a weird, absurdist, gay porn parody.
Right, but it's parodying sometimes very current events.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes he actually has some political themes to them. Although, again, this is it's silly. It's definitely parody.
It's someone who knows how not to take himself seriously.
Yeah.
While writing for a specific audience.
Yes.
While making some kind of statement.
Yeah.
It's actually, there's a lot of sophistication to this guy. Just reading that article and reading some of the stuff that they included in that article, I was like, all right, yeah, I get what he's doing. That's awesome.
So, the voting comes in. He's like, he's on the list now. He could... There's a very real chance he will actually win the Hugo Award.
Well, he's got a lot. And everyone expects him to drop off, though.
Yes. A lot of the other authors were like, I'm dropping off the list. And I think that's how he actually worked his way up to the list of final nominees.
He just didn't give a shit.
Because enough people ahead of him dropped off, which, you know, kept lowering the bar for how many votes you needed, how many nominations you needed to get in. Yeah. But he finally made the list. The other authors, some of the more prominent authors are like, hey, Chuck, if that's your real name, and I know it's not.
Yeah.
Please drop off the list and don't.
This is not an endorsement you want.
Yeah. But Chuck, was like, you know what? No. No, and...
did the opposite.
He did the opposite. He is bucking for a win here. He actually wrote a news story, slammed in the butt by my Hugo nomination.
Yep, it's amazing.
Did you read it?
They included snippets in the article.
He did a couple of other things. He found that nobody was using... What was it like sadpuppies.com?
.com. Yeah, these guys didn't even have their own website.
They did not stake out their website like they should have. So he picked up the Sad Puppies website and proceeds to put on a lot of information about this.
And some really like silly, like he kind of brought his aesthetic to it.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, the Sad Puppies should just be about love and kisses and hugs. Like just very silly stuff that's kind of frivolous seeming, but.
Yeah,
but must really rankle them, which is awesome.
Yeah, he's definitely taken up the mantle for the opposite of what Sad Puppies were going for here.
Right, and the Rabid Puppies.
And the Rabid Puppies. And so now, I hope he wins.
I do too, just to piss off the sort of the conservatives of the.
Yeah, and this is what they wrote. This is their own work.
They have no one. This is their Trump, but. I'm not going to liken him to Trump. I'm just saying they allowed this to happen. No, they didn't allow it to happen. They made it happen.
They screwed with the system.
Yeah.
And it is slamming them in the ass now.
What's great is that what I really like about the story, I think my favorite thing of all is that I think someone made a case in their group and said, look, this guy, obviously not a legitimate author. Look at his subject matter. Look at his titles. He's not going to know what to do. He's going to just drop out. Let's just put him on there to fuck with the system. And they didn't realize that this is actually a fairly sophisticated person, whatever his name is, because no one knows who he is. No one's met him.
Right.
No one knows
what
his real name is. He's very secretive, which is even greater. It makes the story so awesome. So they went up against someone who was way smarter than they thought and who understands how to fuck with people better than they do, apparently. And so who just completely turned the tables and is just like running amok with their plan. And I just fucking love it so much. It's just so great.
So yeah, Google slammed in the ass by my Hugo Award. Mm-hmm. Chuck Tingle. Just Google Chuck Tingle and go nuts.
Yeah, it's fun.
Lots of
slamming in the butt.
Slamming in the butt.
Yeah, and I'm just talking about titles. There's a lot of stories he's written that start with slammed in the butt by. There's just a lot of slamming in the butt. And Space Raptors. Because I think there's a couple of Space Raptors stories. But yeah, the world's so fucking weird. I love it. We're just in a strange time. So that was and then there was a whole email thread that went back and forth about it.
Oh, our email thread.
Yeah, like our email thread. And you came out on the fairly like liberal side of it. And then Colin, who is not a conservative person really, was making more of a centrist argument. And I really respected it just because like the way he was approaching it in the email thread was, Mike, I read the article. I understand what you're saying. But no one's representing the puppies in this. I don't know exactly what their aim was. And, you know, until I know that, I'm not really going to decry them. And I just thought, and I said to you.
That's legitimate. I can't argue with that.
I think we probably all agree on this in the end. But if everyone approached every, like, dissent and argument that way, the world would be such a fucking better place. And it's like, I find no fault with anyone here. You're all doing great. Just keep emailing this kind of shit and arguing the way you're arguing. It's great. I trolled a Trump supporter recently.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Was this on Facebook?
Yeah.
Is this somebody you know?
No. So Ben is, Ben actually had to ban himself from Facebook for like 10 days. Because okay. He got so worked up about being anti-Trump.
Okay.
But I mean, he was like attacking family members on Facebook. Oh, and, yeah. And like, even he was realized like, okay.
This is part of why I don't really use Facebook.
Well, right now.
And I hate to say that to all of our fans. Like, all three of you guys.
If you ever talk to buddies face to Facebook, you're talking to me.
Yes, you're talking to Mike. Right, and it'll, if it's good, it'll get back to me. So don't worry.
Great. I don't even know how to respond to that.
I don't know.
So Ben put this thing on Facebook. And I'm just going to say exactly what happened because it's pretty funny. I don't really know most of the people involved. But Ben had pulled himself back and it got under control again. And then he's been getting more upset as Trump was on the rise again. You know, it got kind of scary there for a while until he sort of imploded. And, you know, I'm just really pulling for that complete implosion. So he recently said, I'm not saying that all Trump supporters are stupid. No, I'm not saying that all stupid people support Trump, but if you support Trump, you're probably dumb. Something mm-hmm. like that. And so, of course, like a bunch of people of his friends were like, yeah, fuck them, haha. But then this one guy, I don't know where he came from, some guy in Jersey, just was like, man, fuck you. Like, you think you're so cool, you're calling people names, you're a fucking douchebag. And then he just, like, started ripping Ben apart. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, I'm like, Ben was pretty attacking. Like, I don't know. But no, fuck it, he's my friend. Fuck this guy. So this guy's going back and forth with a lot of people, and he would make a salient point every, fifth sentence, right?
And just to chime in here, I definitely see how this could be asking for it on Ben's part.
Yes, exactly. And I texted him on the side after I did what I did, and I was like, dude, just so you know, like, I totally don't like this douchebag, but you know better. And he did finally admit, we were texting, he's like, okay, it was a little on the nose. I'm like, yes, it was. Like, and I told him, you need to acknowledge the disenfranchisement of the people who support Trump. Mm. And by acknowledging that, you can then erode it and attack it all you want. But if you don't acknowledge it up front, just name calling. Because he called names and this guy did the same thing. And it just sort of gave license to that.
Yes.
But so what I did was I took that article I was telling you about, which, by the way, I have it upstairs. I want you to read it.
Okay.
So I found it online. So this guy was like, oh, yeah. So he went on his whole rant with Ben was like, look, dude, the facts are all there. Just Google, you know, how his fiscal plan doesn't make sense and all this. And the guy's like, Google flat earth. Google this. Google that. Man, fuck Google. Fuck you. Blah, 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 blah. So I came on and I hadn't been part of the conversation yet. And I was like, yeah, man, this dude has it right, man. Fuck that shit. The internet's dumb. Yo, man. And then some British guy got involved too. And he's like, let me tell you something. Because Ben said, I'm pretty sure the whole world's laughing at us. And the guy said, I'm from England. We are laughing at you. And I was like, fuck that. Didn't we kick the redcoats out 250 years ago? Like, fuck that, dude. Hey, dude, check out this article. It's totally awesome. It was not from the internet. It was published. And then I linked. I went on Google or whatever, the URL shortener.
Uh-huh.
Because the URL for that article is very clearly the title. So I shortened it so you couldn't tell what the article was.
Right.
And then I gave it to him, like totally dumbing myself down the way I spoke to try to get him to read it. And he got really pissed. And then as soon as I had him trapped, I was like, okay. And then I just fucking went off on him. And he didn't write a single thing after that.
Aww.
People kept picking on him and he was just gone. So that was my fun, you know, public service. But I was like, look, man, I get it. You know, there's a disenfranchised former majority. You're denigrated. Your values are being questioned. I understand that. You need to understand that you legitimately could bring about the end of democracy in America by being disenfranchised and voting for this person. I hope you understand that. And I just sort of went at it that way. And he had nothing.
Yeah. Oof. I don't think we have enough time in the world to keep talking about Trump.
it upsets me that we even talk about him at all.
I agree.
And all the news stories recently give me hope that we're just going to he's going to be a massively frightening bump in the road that amounted to nothing in the end. But
I hope it amounts to something. I hope some good comes out of this. I hope the GOP can somehow get their shit together, even if it means they need to take a few years off and burn down some of the horrible, overgrown, poisonous weeds that have grown in the party.
But, okay,
I hope that's what happens.
Here's why I don't think that'll happen. And I've been reading a lot about this. I'm unusually on, like, news article oriented lately because I'm very curious about
this. All right.
But
all right.
Intrinsically, I've said in the past, I think the political system is so flawed, it's unfixable. And here's actually one of the root causes. Politics is a career. It is not a public service. So you have, especially in the GOP, but I'm certainly not letting the Democrats off, but the GOP is in business to stay in business. I mean that literally and figuratively. They have a cushy gig being in the Senate and House and whatever. They don't want to give that up. Everything I've read says that if you were to actually fight against Trump and get him removed as the presumptive candidate, that is political suicide because you are then actually for the first time overturning the popular vote in such an obvious way that there is no coming back from that.
At this point, that I think is correct. There is no reasonable, there's no way he's not going to be the Republican nominee.
He got overwhelmingly the popular vote.
He did.
Right?
Well, also, everybody else dropped out. But it was because he was getting... They were like, I can't fight this.
You can't fight crazy. It doesn't... So, with that being said, and I think that's a fairly accurate assessment, I've seen that in multiple outlets, and I think it's true, no one wants to actually fight against him as bad as it is for the Republican Party.
And I'm not a Republican, but I don't want them to fight against it. I want them... They need to go through this. They need to go down the path of Trump... And fail miserably. That's what needs to happen.
And
they need to go down this road and be like, God, this was such a terrible thing for us to do, and it was disastrous, and we got completely wiped out in the general election. We can't do this again. We need to turn some things around.
We need to get them to the point
What needs to happen.
The GOP as it exists now cannot come back from this. They need to reinvent themselves and take some kind of turn in some direction, right?
Yes.
The Tea Party came and gone. This is just the Trump is the new penultimate crazy.
It's the next level.
You don't go much further than that, right?
But everything that the politics of fear, to put it, I don't know how else to put it.
They're seductive. They're
they've been working, but they've been escalating it. And this is the logical conclusion of all of this. Mm-hmm. This is the logical conclusion of the past 10, 15, or however many years of where the GOP has been heading.
I think it's since the late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
Right. Yeah, this has been inevitable, I think.
Yeah,
they would have gotten to this point sooner or later.
Yeah, it's just frightening.
And you can take it back to like, it's referred to as the Southern strategy often, that the GOP took... years ago, like going back to maybe Barry Goldwater. It's called the Southern Strategy.
70s? Like how far back does that go?
Goldwater. like early 70s, I think.
Okay, not late. I don't think it's the 60s. I think it's the early 70s.
I think so.
Okay.
Slightly before my time. Definitely before my political time.
Way before mine, but I just know the name Goldwater.
But yeah, however many years ago... the Democrats used to be huge in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
easy to forget nowadays.
Yeah. And then civil rights came along, and the Democrats were like, all right, we need to support this. It lost them a lot of support in the South. And the Republicans were like, oh, well, let's go get all those people that let's don't want to vote Democrat anymore. And that happened, and that's been happening for years. And I certainly am not trying to say that the GOP is by its nature racist, because I don't believe that's true.
Abraham Lincoln was a Republican.
Yeah.
Things have changed since then.
I believe that politics of fear, of bigotry, of hatred have been the low-hanging fruit.
Oh, yes.
That the Republican politicians have been picking.
For a long time. They've been catering to it.
Yeah. They've been making the cider from all those low-hanging apples.
Okay, we're taking this too far.
All right, okay, fair enough.
But you bring up a point, and this is the other reason I think the political system is so broken. And it's intrinsically tied to the fact that it's a career path. And that is that it is the worst in us that is the most likely to succeed. It is the hate, it is the anger, it is the ostracism, it is the stigmatization. Those are the characteristics of a despot. Those are the characteristics of a fascist state. Those are the characteristics of a successful political party. I mean, that has been proven time and again. And you can keep a populace in a terrified grip for a very long time if you keep that going. It's very strange how that works, right? In the same way that mass hysteria is a thing. It's just the way we're wired. It's strange. So because of that, when you have people who like rationally say, I want a career in political office, what's the easiest way to guarantee that? Oh, I need to fucking spout hate. I need to make a choice and become Ann Coulter because, wow, I get a lot of fucking attention that way, right? And then you mix media into it and it gets very scary, that witch's brew. But these are the things that I don't see ever going away. So I don't see the Republican Party fixing itself. You know what I mean? And this is just that sad state of existence that I have where I'm pretty much given up on our political system. And eventually a Trump will win. I believe that. I hope I'm not around to see it. I hope my kids aren't around to see it. At some point in this country, a Trump is going to come through the political system and he's going to fucking steamroll it and win. And then we're not going to be America anymore. That is going to happen. I'm fairly convinced of that after this election. I just don't know how long it'll take.
I don't even know how to respond to that. I'm not gonna even. I don't know. I don't think I have a solid argument.
It's for a great way to end a podcast.
But I don't think it's gonna happen this year.
It's not, and that makes me very happy.
Yeah.
Knock on prefab, whatever this desk is.
Yeah. Laminate. Buddies in Space is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. Buddies in Space is a member of the Stolen Dress Entertainment Podcast Network. I was only supposed to read one of those, right?
I think so. All right. It's fine.
Which one did you like more? I like the second one.
Okay.
Visit stolendress.com to check out other Stolen Dress podcasts, blogs, tweets, videos, and books. And plug your promo thing for the beard thing. Guy.
So episode 4 of Clint Westfall's Broda beer and soda pairing vlog will be recording and pushing out. Let's see. This is coming out. It'll already be out by the time you're listening to this. So get out there and listen to it, fucking podcast monkeys.
Are the strings starting to come together?
This is the one. This is the one where it starts to become, I start to take a stand on things and then things start to get heavy.
Exciting.
I'm very, very tightly interwoven into this, but it hasn't been apparent yet. And I may never have a conversation with anyone about it. I just have to say some stuff in my video and then bang, I'm like a catalyst for something.
Cool.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. I'm totally, you know, like doing it legit with the beer and the soda still.
Yeah.
I got good at making
this the pairings. This is my concern.
I actually
face.
Need to get bad at the pairings because I've actually not been minding them so much. I'm like, I got to make them worse. So I'm legitimately gagging when I drink them. Or else, right. Why do it, really?
Go for something local then.
No, actually, I have now.
Jenny Light or something.
Now Jason has specific beer and like beers of origin. Now it's actually that complicated. Like,
oh my god.
This
gosh.
Is like Kaiser Soze level, the shit that he did.
Wow.
Yeah, I know it's an investment, but if you want to see, I don't think anyone's ever done anything like this. Like, this is like Lonely Girl times like a bajillion. This is using 15 different interwoven YouTube stories like that slowly come together and then are layered with multiple meanings and stuff. It's crazy.
Cool.
Yeah. So you are
S. Michael Smith, and you are
M. Michael Crossy. I like the big windmill windup there.
And we are Buddies in Space.
And we're not puppies.
No.
Nope.
Not sad.
Not. I'm not. I'm rabid.
Okay.